So wondering yesterday about my next guest, my main question was, what do I talk about with someone who thinks deeply about so many things? If you have read the work of Siri Hustvedt, you might have had the same doubt about the starting point. She has written 5 novels, 3 books of nonfiction, and a book of poetry. Perhaps best known are What I Loved from 2003, The Sorrows of an American, 2008, and The Shaking Woman or A History of My Nerves from 2010. Her new collection of essays from recent years, Living, Thinking, Looking, reveals Hustvedt's breadth and depth. Living, mostly essays about her life. Thinking, mostly about the life of the mind. Looking, about art. Siri Hustvedt, welcome to WNYC.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
So maybe we can start with your essay on reading, which you just wrote last year. Do you think you read differently today than when you were younger?
That's a very good question. I think that when I was younger, I was probably more deeply influenced by ideas of greatness, so that if I was handed a book that was by supposedly a great author, I swallowed it up. And if I didn't like the text, I blame myself. Now, as a 57-year-old woman, I think I trust my instincts as a reader more than I did then.
Huh. So have you gone back to books that you read and thought maybe you didn't get because you were inadequate, and then decided, well, maybe I don't think as much about that so-called great writer as I'm supposed to?
It goes both ways. I've actually returned to books that I read as an adolescent and discovered that I had entirely misread the book. Kafka is a great example. I didn't see the humor. I didn't understand the ironies at work. So I missed Kafka when I was 15. On the other hand, I mentioned this in the reading essay, a poet, Archibald MacLeish, whom I never liked, and I still don't like Archibald MacLeish. So I was right at 16, or rather the 16-year-old and the 57-year-old agree.
When you read, you say, you engage your capacity for inner speech. The writer becomes your own internal narrator. What's that experience like for you? Are you mingling with the writer as much as being a passive recipient of their words?
Yes, I think this is one of the greatest adventures of reading, which is that you enter another consciousness. You really enter another internal narrator. And you cannot actually think about what you're reading unless you stop and end that process and comment on it. So while you're reading a book, you are in some way touching this other consciousness. I love that.
And you write about rereading Kafka and getting the humor, rereading Middlemarch and getting different things out of the books than you did originally. And that's common, I guess, to get new things from later readings. But you also write about other less conscious processes. Like you recall reading A Tomb for Boris Davidovich by Daniel O'Keefe and liking it very much, but you can't remember a single aspect of the story.
No.
Is that a lesson in the nature of memory?
I think it is. There is some very interesting contemporary neuroscientific research on memory. I think it confirms what many people knew before this neuroscience research, which is that memory is consolidated by emotion, so that what we remember best is exactly the event or the text that moved you the most.
You write about memory as well in your essay, The Real Story, which is about writing fiction versus memoir to explore ideas. You write both. How come?
Well, I think I have two sides of my personality, and maybe they're not as different as I used to think. I'm fascinated by ideas. I'm deeply skeptical, but I keep reading and reading and reading to answer what for me are fundamental questions. They involve memory, but also who we are, what we are, how the mind works, how the mind brain works. What is consciousness? Big ones.
Big ones. And you question the frequent laugh line used by novelists who say, I'm a professional liar. What's your quarrel with that joke?
I think that great fiction is about truth. I don't mean absolute truth with a capital T, I mean truth with a small t. And that the books we carry with us are books that have something to say about the nature of being human. So when writers talk about themselves as liars, I think it's wrong. And my sense when I'm writing fiction is that I can lie, and then I have to revise it. In other words, if I'm evading some essential aspect of the story, then I'm lying, and I fix it.
Can you think of something from your life that you've decided to approach through both fiction and nonfiction at different times and compare them?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, I have written about a stay in the hospital for migraine, both in my very first novel called The Blindfold. The character Iris is actually my name reversed, has an episode or an adventure as a migraine patient in the neurology ward. And I've also written it about that time in this essay book. I was in Mount Sinai, and I do not anymore remember exactly what happened in the hospital with perfect clarity. For example, I cannot recall the face of my doctor. And that's a fascinating aspect of memory, that it dims.
So you could write that fact, but then you could also use that fact to allow yourself to fictionalize the event?
Yes. I think the difference between writing fiction and writing a memoir is very simple, and it does have to do with lying. In other words, we know when we're lying. It's a form of double consciousness. There's some actual story that one is suppressing and telling another story. So the only contract that a memoirist has with the reader is to tell the truth as he or she remembers it. In fiction, that contract does not hold. The truth of fiction is something different. It's not about literal truth, but I think it's about a kind of emotional truth.
Siri Hustvedt, my guest on WNYC, her new collection of essays is called Living, Thinking, Looking. And I gather you're going to read something for us now, and I have no idea what it is from the book, so will you set this up for us?
Yes, I'm talking about the fad for memoir, and it comes from an essay called The Real Story, in which I try to complicate the notion of reality itself, how we remember, and that we do not remember, in fact, the original event, but what we remember is the last time we remembered. This is now pretty clear in neuroscience. It's called reconsolidation, but it was also something that many earlier writers have commented on, including William James, Sigmund Freud, and Wilhelm Wundt. So this is a very short little passage. It seems to me that we have come to a cultural moment in the United States that is inherently suspicious of fiction and attached to an idea of real memory or the true story that is in itself a fantasy. Why write a novel when you can tell the real story? Not long ago, I received a novel in the mail with a letter asking me for a quote. In the form letter, the editor explained that the book is about a rape and that the author herself had been raped. Moreover, the author was willing to talk about her experience of the real rape while doing publicity for the novel about a fictional rape. I have not read the book. It might be good. It might be subtle. What interests me is the inference that the fiction I was being asked to read was more genuine because life and fiction had crossed, as it were. What are we to make of this? The book in question is not a memoir, but a novel, and yet it is being marketed as a form of hybrid. The factual rape is cited to give credence to the fictional rape. There is nothing new about novelists using their own experiences to make a fiction. What seemed new was the need for the publisher to declare what those experiences were.
So there's a commercialization of memory and those boundaries as well between truth and fiction.
Yes, well, I think this does tie up with aspects of the culture connected to reality television. to the fad for memoir, especially very juicy confessional stories. This is not new. It was also going on in the 18th century when both the novel and confessional memoirs were also being published. But I think in order to work this out, and one thinks about fraudulent memoirs as well that have been published, it's important to ask ourselves, what is the nature of memory itself?
And you're interested in essential things about what it means to be human, how we see and remember and feel and interact with each other. Has your writing life been a quest to understand existence as deeply as you can?
I think so. I know it seems very arrogant, and at the same time, there's something humble about it. I've often thought that children and philosophers ask the same questions. You know, why am I here? What is it all about? How do I see? So these questions persist in me, and I also have to say that I do not have hard and fast answers for them.
Right, and to me, you seem to explore with most curiosity in the realms of uncertainty. In these areas, you reject simple explanations. You jump from art to science to philosophy. I think not just to pull together your ideas because you're restless when it comes to relying on any one area too much. You have an essay called "Excursions to the Islands of the Happy Few," which is somewhat about the tension between expertise and deeper knowledge, because every expertise has its blind spots.
Absolutely, I think we do live in a culture where people know more and more about less and less. And sometimes this is a problem. So when I'm exploring through a number of disciplines, what I can finally come up with is what I call zones of focused ambiguity. In other words, each discipline has a frame for viewing, and those frames are not the same. If you apply multiple frames to the same problem, I think you can come up with these zones of ambiguity that are very interesting and potentially fertile areas for more thought.
Mm. And a line from that essay is that losing perspective is an intellectual virtue because it requires mourning, confusion, reorientation, and new thoughts. Wow. By losing perspective, do you mean realizing that someone's expertise conflicts with your own?
Absolutely. I also think that real creativity, dramatic creativity, both in the sciences and the arts, comes from shifting one's position, looking at a problem from a number of points of view. If you think of what happened in physics, this is a huge business, right? Newtonian physics and the shift to quantum. It was shocking. It was startling. And I think that the minds of these physicists who were able to move to quantum theory did so because they were creative, open, and able to entertain the idea that there are multiple perspectives at work.
Of course, when you are in the midst of mourning, confusion, you know, these are not fun states, reorientation, grief. So it can be, I don't know, maybe it's different in the life of the mind than when this is happening because your marriage breaks up or something.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, this returns us, I think, to the story of reading. Reading is a great adventure, but it's also a safe adventure in the sense that one can experience what is happening in the text with, you know, and then put the book down. So intellectual adventures are not the same as being divorced. But that doesn't mean that one doesn't suffer and have joy inside that experience as well.
We have just a few minutes left with the writer Siri Husfeldt. Her new collection of essays, Living, Thinking, Looking. I'll mention that she has two events coming up in conjunction with this book. This Thursday, June 14th at the Strand, in conversation with writer and her husband, Paul Auster, at 7 o'clock for a conversation and signing. And the next Thursday, June 21st, at the Community Bookstore in Brooklyn for a reading, Q&A, and signing. That's 143 7th Avenue. June 21st, next Thursday. So before we run out of time, for people who don't know you, you grew up in Minnesota and came to New York to graduate school at Columbia back in the 70s. Were you seeking New York or a particular department at Columbia or what at that time?
Yes, I got a PhD in English literature in 1986, but I came to New York because I had this idea that this place would allow, you know, intellectual excitement to happen. And in fact, it did. I never left. So New York was a diverse and exciting place to think through various problems that I'm still thinking through.
And your essays are in the first person, even when you're exploring an external subject, like the idea of expertise or the nature of reading. Have you completely given up on the idea of a third-person, objective, quote-unquote, research and writing style?
Well, I don't think that there is any truly objective third person, but I think the third person is extremely valuable. And in a number of my essays, I do switch between the two, but I always include myself. I always include the I, with the acknowledgement that, you know, we can never find an ultimately objective view of things.
Siri Hustvedt, Living, Thinking, Looking, again, Thursday night at 7 o'clock at the Strand, next Thursday night at 7 at the Community Bookstore in Brooklyn. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, thank you. I had a great time.
Lisa Allison, Jody Abergan, Paige Cowett, and Alana Casanova-Burgess produced this program. Our senior producer is Megan Ryan. That's Jason Isaac at the audio controls. I'll talk to you tomorrow morning from the Green Space when we conclude our End of War series. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.